Lively panel, so let's go ahead and get started. My name is Casey Maddox. I serve on the Free Speech and Election Law Executive Committee. Most of my career has been spent suing public universities who violate the First Amendment, which is to say public universities. So I'm personally very excited for this timely conversation about the major campus speech controversy of our time. And to kick that off, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Judge David Strauss. Judge Strauss has served on the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit since 2018. Prior to his appointment, he was an Associate Justice of the Minnesota Supreme Court. He also taught law at the University of Minnesota. Everything he knows, he learned at the University of Kansas, receiving his bachelor's, master's, and law degrees at KU. He clerked for Judge Brunetti on the Ninth Circuit, Judge Ludig on the Fourth Circuit, and Justice Clarence Thomas. Judge Strauss, thank you for moderating this important conversation, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Casey. So this has become one of the really fundamental issues, I think, of our time. As Casey mentioned, I spent some time in academia from 2004 to 2010. It seems like a lifetime ago. But I have also spent time in the classroom more recently teaching as an adjunct professor at various institutions. And one thing that I've noticed is, and maybe distance makes you understand the changes a little bit better, but one of the things that I've noticed is how different people's view, young people's views of speech really is. It used to be the case where talking in class and debating in class and discussing in class were fundamental parts of the educational experience. Not so true anymore, or at least people don't feel comfortable talking in front of others for fear of retribution, for fear of being made fun of, for fear of being, you know, given trouble for the things that they say. And so, and that's sort of reached ahead over the last year or so, particularly given the situation in Israel and in the Middle East. We have encampments on campus, which we're going to talk about as the course of this panel goes on. We also have, and I remember this, there are top 15 or top 20 law school. I don't want to out the law school. But I remember last fall when I was at this very convention, a group of Jewish students came up to me knowing that I'm a Jewish judge and said, we've been completely mistreated by our classmates. We've had things thrown at us as we walk down the hallway. We've been called a lot of anti-Semitic names. And I thought it was shocking to me that that would happen at a law school, but that's sort of the environment we live in. And by the way, judges, this goes beyond campus speech, but judges, professors, are not immune from anti-Semitism either. I certainly have experienced it over the last year, year and a half, as I'm sure many others have as well. And that's not the only problem with free, you know, in the speech area. But I think we're at a little bit of a crossroads where people don't understand what free speech really is or why it's important to democracy. In particular, offensive speech. I think most Americans probably believe that if something's offensive, it's not part of speech, and that's an issue. And so what I'm really happy about is that we get a forum to talk about all this, and we're going to continue to talk about this, I'm quite sure, over the coming years. But it's an issue I feel passionately about, and I know all of our fellow panelists do as well. So the order we're going to go in, we're going to start with Professor Volek. And Professor Volek is the Thomas Siebel Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He was born in the Soviet Union and emigrated to the United States at the age of 7. He's taught at the UCLA School of Law for over 30 years, First Amendment law, copyright law, criminal law, tort law, and firearms regulation and policy, essentially the entire curriculum. Before that, he clerked for Sandra Day O'Connor and Judge Alice Kaczynski, and you probably know him as the founder of the very popular libertarian and conservative blog, The Volek Conspiracy. I'll introduce each panelist as we go along, but for now, I will turn it over to Professor Volek.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the very kind introduction. Thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me to
to be on this panel. It's a tremendously important topic. I think in some respects complicated. Some things shouldn't be very complicated, but some of them are. So I was asked to relatively quickly summarize what kind of the basic rules are with regard to speech and speech-related behavior on campus, and then and maybe lay out a little bit of what the current debates end up being. So let's start with, and I'm going to try to follow along here because it's not to crane my neck. Let's start with Healy v. James. That is the first Supreme Court case that squarely dealt with student speech, and that involved Students for Democratic Society, so pretty far-left students in 1972, and the Supreme Court held that various restrictions imposed on them because of the content of their speech, essentially, I oversimplify, were unconstitutional. But the court did say, look, in the context of the special characteristics of the school environment here, including universities, and in particular, the university doesn't have to tolerate interruptions of classes or substantial interferences with other students' abilities to obtain an education. But despite Tinker, the court said that the First Amendment protections have to apply with as much force on college campuses as in the community at large. Pretty clear in the K-12 context where Tinker was born, that wasn't quite right. There were going to be more restrictions, even if not unlimited restrictions, on K-12 student speech. But when it comes to college and university students, there's going to be full protection. How does that coexist with the preceding line? Let me just add, the court also stressed that the vigilant protection of constitutional freedoms is nowhere more vital than in the community of American schools, again, here referring to universities. So how does that coexist? Well, we actually learned something about it from a case the very next term, Papish v. Board of Curators. And the court says, look, we have repeatedly approved regulatory authority to enforce reasonable regulations as a time, place, and manner of speech. Here, though, the petitioner was expelled because of the content of his speech. And the First Amendment leaves no room for the operation of a dual standard in the academic community with respect to the content of speech. Content restrictions cannot be justified as a non-discriminatory applications of reasonable conduct rules. So I think what we have here, and which fits very well with First Amendment law as it has developed outside the university and has been largely applied in circuit courts since then as to public universities, is that when it comes to content-neutral restrictions, the university has quite considerable latitude, just as the government generally has, but probably more, because it can make sure that university property is essentially dedicated to university purposes and that people can't interfere through means unrelated to content, cannot interfere with the work of the university. But content restrictions, and even more clearly viewpoint restrictions, generally unconstitutional, with, of course, the familiar exception for things like, say, true threats of violence. One thing that, of course, comes up here in universities as elsewhere, is the state action question, right? Public university content restrictions are subject to the First Amendment. But here's one thing that is arising quite frequently these days, even under the outgoing administration. I expect it will arise under the incoming administration as well. Federal government is using its statutory authority to withhold federal funds. It's using it to try to pressure universities into restricting certain kinds of speech. And we have examples of that where the Department of Education essentially said, you didn't do enough to protect students from especially anti-Semitic speech, although similar arguments have been made with regard to racist and as to Title IX, as to anti-gay, anti-trans and such. But in any case, you are not doing enough to protect students against certain speech, so we will withhold the funds. We actually won't withhold it. We'll threaten it, and we'll know that you're going to fold rather than have federal funds be withheld. Now, of course, private universities are not subject to the First Amendment. But when the federal government or state government threatens to withhold funds in order to pressure universities to impose restrictions, then we have a situation the state has commanded a particular result, remove the decision from the sphere of private choice, and that command is state action. So I just want to stress that Healy and Papish not only protect speech at public universities, they also protect speech at private universities from federal government pressure to restrict it. I have a few particular examples, but I'm not sure we need to go into more. I do have a precedent that may be helpful, which is Z Street v. Koskinen, which just goes to show that we Jews are troublemakers and we will set precedents in all sorts of areas. So this involved viewpoint-based denials of charitable tax exemptions there to a pro-Zionist group under the Obama administration. At least that was the alleged. It was alleged that the denial was because of its pro-Zionist position. And the D.C. Circuit said, look, the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint in distribution of benefits, such as the charitable tax exemption. Likewise, I don't think it can discriminate based on viewpoint or mandate viewpoint-based discrimination by a condition on federal funds that are given to universities. Okay. So the private university's own decisions are not constrained by the First Amendment. But it's worth remembering they are constrained by state law. In California, there's actually a statute, which is, some of you may know about, called the Leonard Law, which protects students against discipline based on content of speech, even at private universities, Stanford, USC, and such. In New Jersey and in Pennsylvania, the state courts have interpreted the state constitutions as essentially making large outdoor spaces, think quads, at private universities, think the Princetons and the Penns of the world, into public fora. This may be an unsound interpretation of the state constitution, but it is a matter of state law that the state Supreme Court is the ultimate judge of. Once that's so, that becomes binding on those universities. Many states also have laws that protect employees against discipline based on speech or political activity. So that limits universities' ability to fire faculty and staff, and presumably probably grad students who are working as employees based on their speech. The exact scope of coverage varies from state to state. Of course, also universities are constrained by contractual promises. Student handbooks often promise free speech, as do faculty employment agreements. And there's actually been an important case just about 6 years ago, McAdams v. Marquette University, where there was a professor who was disciplined by Marquette for his speech, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, well, his breach of contract case can go forward because the university actually promised academic freedom and free speech to its faculty. So, of course, there are familiar exceptions to free speech protection. True threats of illegal conduct, solicitation of crime against particular people, Brandenburg incitement, which is actually a slightly different category, narrower in some respects than a solicitation, broader than in others. And as I mentioned, content-neutral time, place, and manner restrictions, most relevant for the debate about encampments. There's a Supreme Court case, Clark v. CCNV, says that the government can ban overnight or over many night protests and that involve camping in public parks. The same thing goes for public universities. Of course, there's no hate speech exception. There's no advocacy of genocide exception. So the protection is quite broad. Now, I want to close with two questions. One is, what about harassment? We keep hearing of course, free speech does not extend to harassment. Part of the problem is it's not clear there's a harassment exception. It's not even clear exactly what harassment means. Justice Alito, then Judge Alito on the Third Circuit, correctly, I think, said, by the way, not all courts agree with this, but quite a few lower courts have echoed this, there is no categorical harassment exception to the First Amendment's free speech clause. And even as to Title VII, where hostile work environment harassment law has most firmly established some degree of restrictions on supposed harassment, even there, courts have recognized, and certainly as to university students, that's that last bullet, that speech can't just be restricted because it's on the theory that it's harassment in the sense that it creates a hostile environment. Now, some such speech could be Threats may be punishable harassment, physical conduct, attacks. I've argued before, although this is more controversial, but I think it's correct, the repeated unwanted speech said to a particular person, where the person either has said stop or it's clear that the person doesn't want to hear it, there's no chance the person will be persuaded or enlightened by it. That can be restricted as harassment. But I don't think that's true as to political advocacy at rallies, on flyers, et cetera, directed to the college community, the chants from the river to the sea, or even worse, even outright anti-Semitic advocacy, I think, cannot be punished as harassment. Let me just close with one important recent decision just from a few weeks ago that I think takes the wrong view on this, although I have to acknowledge it. The judge is a federal judge, and I'm not, so you decide. I report, you decide. So this was a lawsuit brought by the Brandeis Center against Harvard, and the court allowed that lawsuit to go forward and essentially a Title VI hostile environment theory, because Harvard does not appear to have taken actions in response to student groups ejecting pro-Israel students from a demonstration. Well, that may very well be actionable harassment, because that is actually discriminatory behavior, possibly based on people's religion or national origin, although at the very least based on their ideas. So it's not protected, I think, by the First Amendment. Likewise, there was an incident, which I think is complicated, but does seem to be quite troublesome, professors pressuring Israeli students to abandon a pro-Israel class project. But the court also faulted Harvard for not taking any actions in response to an October 8th student group letter purporting to hold the Israeli regime entirely responsible for all unfolding violence and stating that it's the only one to blame. That is most emphatically not my own view, but it is clearly a view that is protected by the First Amendment. I think Harvard ought not punish students for that. Now, Harvard would have the First Amendment right to speak out against that, but I think it has the First Amendment right not to speak out against that. That I don't think a university should be obligated to respond to even things that we think are very unwise, evil, maybe even anti-Semitic criticisms of Israel. I don't think Harvard can be properly sued, it seems to me, or held liable at least. You can sue anyone for anything, but can be held liable for that. Likewise, there's just some other examples there. Protesters celebrating the terrorist attacks and referring to it as an act of justified resistance, saying, chanting for Intifada revolution, from the water to the water, Palestine will be Arab. Note, there's no way of excusing that as, oh, it just means free in the sense of a single state that's democratic and equal. No, they want it to be Arab. They're entitled to want it to be Arab. It's not my view, maybe a bad view. I think it's a bad view, but that is a view that I think they're entitled to express and the university should not have any obligation to try to suppress. And there are some other examples along those lines, some of them outright anti-Semitic, some anti-Israel. My claim here is that, in fact, here, this particular district court has gone too far in allowing possible liability against Harvard based on the viewpoint expressed by its students and based on Harvard's own First Amendment protected decision not to try to respond or denounce that viewpoint. And now we're on. We're on to the next.
As always, I enjoy hearing from you, Gene. An excellent summary of some of the doctrine in this area. Next, we move on to Professor Ken Marcus, who's the founder and chairman of the Lewis Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law, professor and lecturer at law at George Washington University, and author of The Definition of Anti-Semitism and Jewish Identity and Civil Rights in America. He's also served as the Assistant U.S. Secretary for Education for Civil Rights, had been a partner at two major law firms, and some of you may know him as the chair of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group. Take it away.
Thank you, Judge. And as the chair of a different practice group, I am particularly honored to be here, an invitation that I have to attribute to the fact that you don't remember the last time I spoke to this group. a couple of us were just comparing notes before the panel. By my count, I think that those who favor the First Amendment on this panel have a 4-0 advantage over those who do not. Which means that if we don't win this one, it's pretty darn pathetic. I'm going to say a few words about the surrounding context. I think the judge's introduction and perhaps also Professor Volokh's remarks confirm for me the notion that this campus chaos referred to is about the anti-Semitic incidents over the last year plus. I have to say I just came from a Board of Trustees orientation where we were told that the most significant controversy that we could possibly deal with as trustees was sports. Not transgender in sports, but cutting sports teams. That's the third rail. When we talk about October 7, we're talking about Hamas atrocities in which there were a large number of people murdered in an organized activity, people who were sexually assaulted, corpses that were desecrated in various ways, torture, and of course, kidnapping. When we talk about the campus response, we're including incidents that began immediately after news of the atrocity came and before Israeli troops entered Gaza, which means that those who were protesting in favor of the resistance in the immediate aftermath of the incident were not protesting against the Israeli encroachment, but rather in favor of the atrocities. This is something that we saw on campuses around the country. We have heard at the Brandeis Center reports of physical assault on dozens of campuses. We have seen incidents of vandalism and other conduct that I think is indisputably outside of the scope of the First Amendment. Generally, some of these court opinions that we've been seeing lately have not been so much about the First Amendment as about deliberate indifference because the cases pending before the courts now have so much conduct that is indisputably not protected speech. I'm not going to comment on a pending lawsuit for which the Brandeis Center is a party, but if you do read the Brandeis Center complaint, I think you'll see that there is even more conduct, including physical assault, than what has been described. So what do we make of a situation in which on our college campuses we saw so many protests in favor of a terrorist organization in the immediate aftermath of such atrocities? There was a mention of a document signed by dozens of student organizations at Harvard. Put aside the question of the First Amendment, when there are dozens of student organizations that are blaming Israel or excusing Hamas in this context, it should be a wake-up call for us. It should be a wake-up call that goes beyond individual or particular incidents. And it's a question not just of anti-Semitism. That's a field that I focus on at the Louis D. Brandeis Center is anti-Semitism. But when you have, on so many college campuses, so much support for a resistance, which we know is often a code word for Hamas, we have to ask the question whether these students, disproportionately at some of our most prestigious universities, are capable of carrying on democratic institutions into the next generation. This is something that I believe did not begin at October 7, but our awareness of it should certainly have been sparked by then, and it's something that we should not turn away from. We should remember the incident not just because of the victims and not just because of an encampment or a particular incident, but because it is an indication to us beyond the particular vandalism, beyond the particular physical assaults, it is an indication to us of a very significant cultural rot in our society, including in particular some of our leading institutions, and that it really is disproportionate leading institutions, according not just to anecdotal, but survey and other data. University administrators, I'll just accept Chicago from all of this, but university administrators often act as if things are happening on their campus organically over which they can have no control. Somebody does something or says something and they might, it just happens. And they have to figure out, was it protected? Was it not protected? Do they have to let it be? Do they not have to let it be? But they don't ask the question, did we create this? And are we perpetuating the conditions under which it will continue? There was a lot of focus on university presidents who failed to condemn the Hamas atrocities or continuing protests and lacked the moral clarity to do it. And there was some applause for those who did. Ben Sasse, for instance, in Florida, issue strong condemnation. But it's one thing to condemn something that happened abroad or even protests, and another thing to ask the question, what's going on here? What are we doing that sustains it? And what will we do to change it? So here we have universities that have students. I'll give you an example. One student in a southern university was being disciplined for what he did in the wake of October 7. And he said, I don't get it. I'm not doing anything different than what I said I was doing when I wrote my admissions essay. This is the sort of activism that got me into here. And I think the same could be said by many of the faculty members who are engaged in controversial activity. In many cases, they are part of departments where they have an orthodox view, which if they deviated from it, they would not have been hired in the first place. We have curricula where class after class is laden with anti-Zionism, but also with anti-Americanism and disdain for Western values. To me, the question of how you deal with a particular incident is, and I admit that professionally often I deal with responding to particular incidents, and we should. If there are incidents of violence, vandalism, certain forms of discrimination, we need to deal with them. But that's just incidental. That's just one level. Even if we could effectively respond to each and every incident that comes to our attention, we're not dealing with the underlying problem that has now been revealed to us. Beneath those incidents, we need to be asking how it is, after plowing so much time and treasure into DEI to solve the problems of discrimination and harassment, we're only creating campuses that are less inclusive and less equitable. And where, in fact, notions of oppressor and oppressed too often fall into stereotypes of some groups, including Jews, being powerful and controlling and others not. A whole level of ideology that's actually paid for by the university supposedly to address the problems that it perpetuates. And then we have beyond that the question of what is the void? What is the vacuum that this is filling? Why is it that our institutions no longer can speak in a self-confident way about shared values other than perhaps diversity of race or ethnicity? Why is it that we no longer have, in a very serious way at most of our great universities, a foundation upon cultural values that are simply going to be inconsistent with what's happening? A true change is not going to be a matter of addressing specific incidents. It's going to be a matter of building institutions upon a foundation of values that won't lead us to the DEI, the CRT, the various other ideologies that then sustain the various forms of hate that we're seeing now. And we have to understand that while much of this hate may be fueled from contributions from abroad, we see some of it, we hear it anecdotally, and there are intelligence reports that some of it is fueled by foreign funds. But we also have to acknowledge that we're paying for it ourselves. We're paying for it ourselves with taxpayer money in public institutions and federally assisted institutions that support monolithically anti-Western curricula. We're paying for it with liberated ethnic studies curricula in the high schools, which will lead to another generation that could be worse than what's in college. as bad as things were over the last year and a half on college campuses, we're now seeing high schools substantially worse than they were 2 years ago, which means incoming freshmen who were educated in U.S. high school are now going to be as much a part of the problem as anything. I don't want to downplay the issue of the freedom of speech here. I believe in it. It's conceivable that we have differences. It's conceivable that we don't really have differences. It's conceivable that some of it is factual. And again, I don't want to go into a particular case that's here. But what I would say is, I do think that we need, as people who are fighting for equal opportunity, to also say we need to have freedom of speech on our campuses. But we also have to understand that doesn't solve the problem. Nor does even individual compliance activity on bias incidents solve the problem. We need to respect both freedom of speech and equal protection, but we also have to understand that the fundamental crisis that we have right now, and it is truly a crisis, is one of values, not just the negative values that are being taught, but also the fundamental values that are not. Thank you.
What a fabulous panel. This is, I think it's an important conversation we're having. The next speaker, who is a frequent speaker at our Federalist Society National Convention and is truly a friend, I think, of the Federalist Society, is Nadine Strossen. She's emeritus professor from New York Law School, past president of the ACLU, senior fellow with FIRE, which you might have read about online, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education that fights some of these free speech battles that happen in higher education institutions. And she's a frequent media commentator on constitutional law and civil liberties. She is also the author of Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship, and also of Free Speech, What Everyone Needs to Know. She has a long list of organizations to which she belongs and honors to which she's received. You can certainly look it up on her bio, but without further ado, let's get to hear what Nadine wants to say.
I want to stand just so I can see everybody. When I was sitting here, I was blocked from some of the audience. And I asked that I go last of the three of us professor types before we get to the administrator type, precisely because I have such enormous respect for both Eugene and Ken, and I wanted to hear what they had to say, and then I'll try to fill in some gaps, not to be too redundant, but from my own special experience and perspective. Before I do that, though, I wanted to make two introductory points. One was that I saw this morning on my calendar that today is the anniversary of, does everybody here know this, the Articles of Confederation. And it occurred to me, as Judge Strauss kindly said, I've been speaking at this convention for many years. It's always at this time of year. Maybe this isn't a coincidence, because the Articles of Confederation, I looked it up on Wikipedia, the guiding principle was the independence and sovereignty of the states and establishing a weak central government. So, on a more somber but also, you know, deeply heartfelt note, I want to take the occasion to mourn the passing of Ted Olson recently, who was such a stalwart of this organization and also a stalwart of American law and also just a personal embodiment of the reason, David, Judge Strauss, why I am always so happy to accept invitations to this organization, because not only from the beginning have you welcomed different ideologies, different perspectives on the issues that you hold most dear. I know that's woven into your fabric, but Ted was somebody who went beyond that and was, from my very first appearance here, so warmly welcoming on an individual and personal level. And both of these dimensions of welcoming different perspectives, but also welcoming friendship and collegiality on a personal level with people with whom you have deep disagreements. This is the antithesis of what is taken for granted in our polarized society today. So I hope that we would have a much better legal society, legal community, and society generally if everybody would follow in the footsteps of the great Ted Olson. Now, Ken, it's really hard to follow in your footsteps because you spoke with such passion and such eloquence about issues that go beyond technical legal issues, which is what is my forte. Although that said, Judge Strauss mentioned the title of a book I published in 2018, Hate, Why We Should Resist It with Free Speech, Not Censorship. That was a book, and all of my other pronouncements constantly since then go beyond just not censoring ideas that we disagree with, because I believe it's ultimately ineffective at best and counterproductive at worst for countering every kind of hatred or discrimination, including anti-Semitism, something that has affected me in my life very closely. But also that if we really want to do something effective, we have to go beyond simply not censoring. And I think especially for those of us who defend free speech, we have a moral obligation. I'm sure most of us also have a personal desire, but I think we have a special moral responsibility to do the something else instead of censorship that would, in my view, be more effective in countering the attitudes that, after all, are what we are trying to deal with, not just the superficial manifestations that come out in the hateful and ignorant slogans that we've been hearing on campus, but actually changing people's minds, changing their habits of mind, changing their habits and patterns of interacting with each other. And I think ultimately that to me was probably the least satisfying aspect of that infamous congressional testimony by my alma mater, university president, and others. Yes, they gave the technically correct legal answer, and that's important, that you cannot censor expression solely because of how abhorrent the ideas might be. That's very important. But that's not enough. You know, the great Supreme Court Justice, who is the namesake of Ken Marcus's terrific organization, Justice Louis Brandeis, in the same breath in which he first formulated what is often called the emergency principle, that only an emergency can justify an exception to speech protection, he then went on to talk about what else you do. You use education. You use persuasion. And to me, as a lifelong educator, it was especially disappointing to have the presidents of these premier educational institutions not talking about the educational deficits and the educational steps that should be taken on those campuses. Well, having said all of that, I'm now going to revert to my technical First Amendment expertise. And I do think Eugene and I and Ken, all three of us, were speaking at another conference today. And Eugene was introduced as probably the foremost, and no, the foremost free speech expert in the country. And I completely agree with that. As Eugene can attest, every time I have a question, he's my go-to person. But he had only a short amount of time, so I can add a few points to the excellent points that he made. And what I'm going to do is draw upon the reflections that informed my book that came out last year, part of a trade-named series by Oxford University Press, What Everyone Needs to Know. And even though that series had existed for 20 years, they didn't have one on free speech yet, which was quite amazing. And I had been giving thousands, no exaggeration, of presentations about free speech, encountering questions, tens of thousands of questions. And the format of this series is that it's in question and answer format. And that forced me to distill this really complex body of law that has developed over more than 100 years now. But what I came to appreciate are a few shining clarion principles that I think are so easy to understand and would go a long way to eliminating some of the campus chaos. That's the title of our panel here, campus chaos that surrounds misunderstandings about free speech. And let me tell you, what I have come to appreciate is that contrary to all kinds of caricatures and distortions that you will hear from people who are attacking free speech, and it's constant, it seems like every year, maybe every month, there are new books that come out from different ends of the ideological spectrum attacking free speech. Politicians, again, left to right, are constantly attacking free speech. But when you get down to it, they are really attacking a caricature. How often do they say, for example, oh, American law is ridiculously absolutist and no exceptions whatsoever, and you free speech champions, you deny that speech can do any harm. And none of that is true. When you come down to it, our law very sensibly does empower government to restrict the speech that is the most dangerous. We can cite Brandeis's emergency principle. Speech that, considered in all of the facts and circumstances, either directly causes or imminently threatens certain specific serious harm. And the harm has to go beyond my feelings are hurt. And by the way, I don't mean to trivialize that. I know speech can be deeply wounding and traumatizing and upsetting, but the dangers of empowering government to punish speech on that kind of harm far outweigh the harm of the speech itself, as we've learned through a bitter history. But conversely, I've explained that government does have power to restrict the speech that is the most dangerous, but government is disempowered from engaging in the censorship that is the most dangerous. And this principle is usually referred to as the viewpoint neutrality or content neutrality principle. No matter how loathsome, no matter how loathed the viewpoint, the message, the content, the idea, that alone is never enough to justify censorship, because that is so dangerous for government to pick and choose rather than leaving it to we the people and we as individuals and we as wielding sovereign power to make those determinations. And I think those principles make such absolute common sense. If we would have those in mind as a lodestar, it would go a long way to making people not only understand what our system of free speech is, but also support it. And let me just say that I'm not going to talk any longer. I'm just going to make one more point. And that is that one of the things that I've come to appreciate since October 7th is that if we are to have a meaningful, robust free speech climate on our campuses, where everybody in the community is empowered to and encouraged to exercise free speech equally and fully, then two things are important. I used to only talk about one of them or focus on one of them. The first one is that campus officials should not restrict speech that is protected. Okay, but since October 7th, I've also come to realize more poignantly than ever that equally important for that robust free speech climate is that campuses should restrict expressive conduct that is not protected speech, because that in turn suppresses and stifles the speech of others. I think that the law is excellent. I think that excellent as it is, it obviously has to be enforced in particular situations. So groups like FIRE and Ken's organization and many others are doing that. But that is only a necessary and not a sufficient prerequisite for the kind of campus climate that we want, which will reflect and embody what I consider to be my personal interpretation of DEI, which is diversity, equality, and inclusion for every person, regardless of who you are, and also regardless of what you believe. Thank you.
Thank you, Nadine. That was excellent. So I think we've gotten to the point where I think all three of our panelists, to at least a certain degree, agree that we have a problem in institutions of higher education. We may start talking about some of the solutions. That's really what our fourth panelist is for. He certainly does not purport to know all the answers, but I thought it was important to put someone on the panel who's dealt with free speech and the University of Chicago more broadly, but the University of Chicago Law School in particular, has long been a bastion that has done of free speech. And for the most part, Chicago's done a good job of making sure everybody's voice is heard, exactly what Nadine has mentioned. So our last speaker is Tom Miles, who's the dean and a professor of law and economics at the University of Chicago Law School. I initially got to know him when I was an academic from his numerous empirical articles that he has written over the years, particularly in the area of judicial behavior. He has a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago, JD from Harvard Law School, and he clerked for Judge Jay Bybee on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. So hopefully you have some answers, Dean, because we are in a tough situation.
Well, thank you very much, Judge. It's a great honor to be here, and really humbling to be part of this this panel. I did feel a little bit like the odd person out on this panel because I'm sort of, I think, offering a perspective of sort of the view from the ground about how are these challenges dealt with. And then I also feel a little bit being the odd person out because I think that the University of Chicago's approach in many ways has been distinctive. When I meet so many lawyers out in the world of practice, they say, the University of Chicago, that's a distinctive institution, which I take as a high compliment. I think some of the ways in which we're distinctive is that we're very focused, I think, on our mission of research and of teaching. And then there's something about the, I would call it, the Chicago disposition, a certain outlook or habit of mind that loves to question, that loves the tough question, loves receiving the tough question, and is often contrarian. But I think also one of the ways in which we're distinctive is the particular commitment that we've had to free expression. So all of that is to say, like, maybe in some sense I'm a bad choice to speak to this because the view here is not representative, but maybe it's helpful in that the extent to which we can show some signs of hope or progress on these issues, they might be illuminating for others. So let me talk a little bit about what Chicago, the university, has done in this area and that I think is important, and then talk about some other things that we've done in the law school. So many of you may know the University of Chicago has a set of formalized policies regarding free expression on campus, and I think the most famous one of these is the 2014 report of a faculty committee that was chaired by our former dean and former provost, Jeff Stone, prominent First Amendment scholar. And this is known as sort of the Chicago Principles or the Stone Report. And this really reaffirms the university's view that we want to be a place of robust and fierce debate in our community, that we're not a place in which the university is going to suppress speech, no matter how offensive and challenging it may be. But I think it's also important to recognize that this is not the only sort of approach the university has taken to these issues, and it didn't start thinking about these issues in 2014. The university's thinking about this really goes back to our founding and sees the mission of scholarship and teaching as being supported and crucial input being an environment of free expression where any question can be asked, any topic can be pursued. And this also goes to, back in 1967, another report from the faculty about what's known as institutional neutrality. And this is the report that was chaired by First Amendment scholar Harry Calvin, known as the Calvin Report or Calvin Principle, that the university does not take positions on issues of the day, issues of general social or political questions. Instead, the university is not to be a critic, it is to be the home of the critic, as the report describes. And this is, of course, not to chill speech and to chill inquiry at the university. There have been other efforts to formalize policies. In 2013, there was a report about protest on campus. And the university, the report, which was chaired by our constitutional law scholar, David Strauss, and the Strauss report, was about the importance of protest, that protest we celebrate as a form of speech. And then in 2017, 2018, there was a report developed about what do we do when there are disruptions that go beyond protests that actually disrupt the university. What's our process for adjudicating those and for disciplining those? And that was a report that was chaired by our colleague, Professor Randy Picker. So I'm very proud of the law school's distinctive role in developing this policy architecture. And since then, since the 2014 Stone Report, about 100 universities have adopted that. And yet, you think about that time period since then, that's been the time period of the campus chaos that's the namesake of this panel. So I think the lesson we learned from that, and certainly the lesson we've learned at the University of Chicago, is that the policies alone don't get us to a place of a great speech environment. That's, we need more beyond that. So let me describe some of the things that we do, because it's really about cultures and value. As Ken's remarks indicated, it's about very much the values. And so we communicate in a number of different ways. I think certainly the law school, but also our college, really communicates what we want the academic environment to be at the university, such that students, when they apply, understand what kind of community they're coming into. Our college has a tradition that there is an address which is given every fall as part of their orientation that's called the Aims of Education Address, which I think the title encapsulates for you very much what they're informing students as they come in to start their college careers. This is what you're here for, right? This is the aims of education. And then most recently, in last year, in 2023, the university established a university-wide center called the Forum for Free Inquiry and Expression. And our faculty colleague in the law school, Tom Ginsberg, is the faculty director of that. And they are doing a number of things to have programming to communicate these values, to provide examples of these values, both for us internally and potentially for external audiences as well. One of the first things they have done is they've issued a book, which is now available on Amazon and other places, called The Chicago Canon. And what this does is includes those policy statements, as well as a whole set of speeches and reports and other things that the university and its leaders have issued around these issues of discourse and speech on campus. And I think that's a really important guidebook for us, and many lessons can be learned from it. You know, as my service as dean, I'm now in my 10th year as dean. I'm going to step down at the end of the year. And as my service wraps up, one of the things that I reflect on is that I've met so many alumni who reflect on their experiences of the law school and what the speech environment was like then. And as I think the panel has alluded to, maybe the current generation is different in some ways, and there's been a lot of kind of conversation about that. And so maybe there was a time when we could take for granted that students who came to our law school or any law school expected or took it for granted that they were going to be exposed to a wide range of views, many of which were going to be challenging on some of the toughest issues facing our world. And now I think so many, we've kind of observed that so many students who are seeking to go to law schools maybe have a different set of values about, or different set of expectations about, what is the relationship between a student and a university. And we've tried to take more effort then to impart what we think of as our values to do that. We certainly do that in admissions, in talking about what kind of environment students would be coming to here. I started the practice, I think now 7 or 8 years ago, of sending each one of our incoming 1Ls a letter in July, along with a monograph on the history of academic freedom and free expression at the university that's written by our dean of the college, John Boyer. And in that letter, I tell them, okay, here's your first reading assignment. And it is really a congratulatory letter as well to tell them you've come to a very special place that really values speech and discourse. A few years ago, we started doing an orientation exercise where students in orientation get a copy of the university's speech principles, and then with our faculty, we developed a set of hypotheticals that have a perhaps ripped from the headlines flavor to them about speech controversies on campus. And then the students in orientation come together in a small group with a faculty member and then apply the principles to that hypothetical. It gives the students an opportunity to realize, what are the real tough value choices at stake here? It gives the students an opportunity to say, oh, I disagree with the university's approach, and then invites a conversation about what would the alternative be and what would the challenges of that be. And I have to say, it's really thanks to our faculty who believe in the importance of our academic environment that spend their time and energy to do this because they want to see a robust speech environment on our faculty. You know, I can mention a few other examples, but you know, what I'll do is I'll just say simply the way we've started to think about this is, in a way, this is a teaching opportunity for us. We're an educational institution. One of our key missions is teaching. I did notice we've got a number of students here from the University of Chicago Law School. It's great to see you here. I'm a little puzzled as to why you're here in Washington while classes are in session. Chicago, we can talk about that later. But we view kind of our teaching mission as not only about like creating a speech commons that upholds the First Amendment principles, but it's also we're trying to educate the next generation of legal professionals. And a really important skill for legal professionals is being able to talk about very tough issues with people who think and believe and experience the world very differently than they do. That's a very hard thing to do. And we try to do that in the classroom, but we also have to recognize we do it outside of the classroom. It's an acquired skill. It's hard. You know, our former university president, Hannah Gray, has a famous line that I'll paraphrase here. She said, you know, education is not supposed to make students comfortable. It's supposed to make them think. And that means it's hard, and I think universities need to work on it. And I by no means want to say that we've always gotten it right, but I think we've tried to make that shift from understanding what are the policies we need to have in place to support this, and then what are the steps we need to take to impart the values, because I don't think the policies alone are going to get us there. And then what I say, just to go back to the kinds of things I say to admitted students, is as you think about what law school you want to go to, you should want this kind of education. You should want every law school to give you this kind of education. So I'll thank you again for the opportunity to be here.
Thanks, Tom. I'll take responsibility for bringing you here, and sorry to all the Chicago students for getting you in trouble. what we'll do now is I want to give everyone a chance to respond. I have a question I think is really important that I'll ask in just a moment, and then we'll open it up to everyone for comments. So let's start in the same order that we went earlier, so with Eugene.
Sure. So very much appreciate everybody's remarks. I think there's a lot here and a lot to agree with. One of the things that I was put in mind of both by our talk today, but before as well, is there's a poem by Rudyard Kipling. There are a lot of poems by Kipling that are surprisingly apt. This one is, of all things, about the Boer War, a war that the British almost lost in a situation where they were absolutely positive that they would win. They are the mighty empire against a bunch of backwoodsy South African Boer, so essentially Dutch settlers. Eventually, they won at a very considerable cost to them, and especially to the Boers and the Boer civilians. But Kipling writes a poem about this, and the poem is called The Lesson. And there's the two lines that I most remember, I'm just making sure I'm quoting them right, is, "Let us admit it fairly, as a business people should. We have had no end of a lesson. It will do us no end of good." And he was a patriotic Englishman. He did not appreciate what happened there. But he thought that it was important to remind fellow Englishmen that this is a lesson. And this is, I think, what one thing that I think people on the panel realize, but some other people miss, when they say, you know, we want to shut down all of these awful protesters because their views are so awful. We need to appreciate the lesson. We are now learning what's actually going on in people's minds, we're learning what's actually going on in universities. That's a very important thing for us to understand, in part because it may bear on admissions, it may bear on the curriculum, it may bear on all sorts of things. That's one, maybe it just makes you feel happier. One upside of hearing all of this awful stuff is that there is something, I think, of a valuable lesson. Let me suggest that there's also some tension in what we're hearing. And, you know, it may be one of those things where both sides are right in large measure, but we need to think about it. So one problem, I think, that Ken correctly identified is we are admitting students with an eye towards them being activists. And part of the problem is, I remember when I was that age, and I was an idiot. And, you know, I think most of us, thinking back, would say, wow, how could I have... One is, how could I have believed the things that I believe? But actually, that's not so much it. How could I have believed so strongly about things that I now realize are actually quite complex? So I do think that one of the problems is there's too much moral clarity going on the part of the students. And maybe we should be admitting students, at the very least, in a way that doesn't artificially increase the number of people who come in with sort of a false moral clarity. At the same time, I do want to point out that one of the things that I think the Calvin Report correctly says is the university should, at the very least, be extremely hesitant in assuming moral clarity in its public comments. You know, you might say, well, obviously genocide should be condemned, but as we see in this whole debate about what's been happening in Israel and in Gaza, different people use genocide to refer to different things. I have a pretty good sense of where I think it falls. I don't view for example, the attacks on Gaza as genocide. I view them as legitimate military action. But obviously, people disagree. I don't think that our universities should be kind of responding even with more speech in the sense of, here's moral clarity. We're not going to suppress your pro-Hamas speech. We're just going to tell you what awful people you are, or even what awful people Hamas is. Again, I'm quite confident that Hamas are awful people. But I'm not sure that even on something like that, universities really ought to be speaking out. I'm not sure that they shouldn't be. Maybe this is an area where they ought to. But I think, in at least if in a rule utilitarian sense, maybe we ought to be stepping away from moral clarity on the part of the administration as well as the students. So maybe I'm wrong, but that's kind of the reaction that I had.
All right, Ken.
Well, I'm humbled to be in this group. I don't think that the problem is so much protesters per se. While I do think that universities should be about advancement and dissemination of learning, and that should be the focus of students, I don't think it's a terrible thing that there are students engaged in some protests. I don't even think that there is a problem with students engaged in wrong-headed protests. There is a problem with large numbers of students engaged in extremely wrong-headed protests that are also morally extremely problematic, but that isn't necessarily a problem that we should handle through censorship, nor is it a problem that we should ignore. I happen to be an admirer of the Chicago principles and the Calvin principles. I don't think they necessarily should be applied in every single institution. There are different sorts of institutions, religious as well as secular, research and non-research, but they should be applied, in my view, to a large number of institutions. I think that you might have suggested at one point that they're not necessarily the answer to all things, right? And I think that that is right. I have criticized some people who have said, use the Chicago principles, period, in situations where that shouldn't be the end of the situation. And I have to say, forgive me, I know there are some lawyers in the room. I have to say that administrators who are lawyers sometimes have the problem that when an incident occurs on their campus, especially a hate or bias incident, they will simply ask the question, is it protected or is it not protected? If it's not protected, they think, oh, I punish. If it is protected, they think, oh, I do nothing.
Right.
It may be that both of those answers will be wrong in some context. Just because you can punish doesn't mean you must punish. And just because you can't censor doesn't mean that your job is done. It might just mean that your job is harder because there are things that you need to do that are non-regulatory. That is to say, they don't involve punishment or restriction or chilling of speech. That just means you have to work harder to figure out how to deal with this problem.
Tom, I want to say that I'm a great admirer of the Chicago canon. I actually had the honor of blurbing that collection. And, you know, many of us think, wow, Chicago was so ahead of the curve in adopting institutional neutrality in 1967. But it actually, as you know, traces back to the founding of the university in the 19th century, as the book well documents. So, again, though, I want to stress that even the gold standard University of Chicago policies and principles are not enough to actually bring about a free speech climate on that campus. And I have a good friend who graduated from the University of Chicago last year, and she published she's Jewish, she's a total free speech advocate. She was invited by Brett Stevens, the editor of Sapir, a scholarly intellectual publication that focuses on Jewish issues. And there was an issue, a collection on Jews and cancel culture, and he invited her to contribute from the student perspective. And you can read it. It's public, so I can mention her name, Olivia Gross. At the end of the article, she's been talking about how, despite all the free speech policy protections, the main inhibiting factor, even upon somebody like her and her coterie of devoutly committed to free speech friends, is peer pressure and cancellation and punishment by peers, which in her case happened early on in her college career. And she said, before any of us raise our hands in class or even speak to each other in a public setting such as a campus cafeteria, we ask ourselves, is it worth it? And sadly, I have to say, based on a lot of evidence, including people who proudly brag that they would overtly discriminate against people whose views that they dislike and campaign to cancel them, it probably isn't worth it. In some rational utilitarian sense, you probably have more to lose than you have to gain. Nevertheless, she had the courage, and she said at the end of this piece, she says, even as I'm coming to the end of this piece, before I hit send, I'm really asking myself, is it worth it? Because she got a lot of pressure from even being published in a collection that also included a piece by Josh Katz, formerly of Princeton University, who had been subject to cancellation there because, like, the guilt by association. And this is, I'm citing her as a, you know, when we hear an individual story, it's very powerful, but this is backed up by survey data. FIRE famously issues a ranking of universities. Now it's up to something like 255 campuses on the free speech climate, of which policies are an important factor in the ranking, as are administrative actions, as are retaliations and deplatforming, and et cetera, et cetera. One of the constituent elements in the rankings is a campus climate survey. And this is done by College Pulse, which specializes in surveying student attitudes. And of all the chilling statements in the most recent FIRE report, to me, the most chilling was this, that when you look at the difference between school that's ranked number one and school that's ranked number 255. On that particular vector of do students feel comfortable speaking, or are they in fact self-censoring because of fear of peer pressure, not fear of faculty punishment or administrative punishment? On that key factor, and this is an exact quote, the difference between school number one and school number 255 was negligible. So, you know, we policies are great, they're necessary, but we have to go beyond that. And I'm so happy that the students are here and not in Chicago, because, we are not your peers. That goes without saying. And I think that change within the peer culture really has to come from you yourselves. And I salute the students who have been leaders in the Federalist Society, because this organization, from its very beginning, has pledged to bring in, to have debates, not to just be preaching to the choir, but to bring in people with different perspectives. And I know, since I often speak at student Federalist Society chapters, that they are required to have not just one speaker, but to do their very, very best to have another speaker with a different perspective. They are also very strongly encouraged to co-sponsor their events with student organizations that have very different perspectives. So the Federalist Society, at its best, when it's living up to its founding and guiding principles, will embody and instill within the student body that kind of free speech and critical inquiry and civil discourse culture. So we're really counting on you and thanking you.
Thanks. Tom, anything else?
Sure. I mean, I'll just go back to the scenario that was posed at the beginning about, should activists not be, admitted? I think if schools took that approach, if they say, oh, we're not going to admit activists, well, it would make for more peaceful campuses. But I would worry a lot about what kind of viewpoint discrimination might be going on in ways that are not very transparent. I mean, I think it's really incumbent upon the admissions staff and the faculty who are involved in admissions to really evaluate whether the applicant is interested in coming to that school to obtain an education, or are they interested in coming to that school to use it as a site for whatever they want to advance. And I would think it's really important then to see, is the student really a good fit for the kinds of career path, the sort of education that's being looked for? I'd be really reluctant to go to have hard rules there about what the right approach is.
Right. I just want to make clear, I'm not saying no activists. I'm just saying that we seem to have come up with a situation. I had kids, many of you are in the same situation, who were juniors and seniors a couple of years ago, and were saying, what can we add to their resume to do this? And we knew that a lot of other kids, they were checking the activist box, and they were doing that. Now, fortunately, one of my sons is 6'4", so he could check the volleyball box.
All right. Well, I hope to open, have a little time for questions, but I want to ask a question of my own. So returning to the source of a lot of these protests, Ken, you actually mentioned this briefly, and I want to open it up to everybody, but I had the real honor of going with a number of other judges to Israel in the spring. And one of the things that became clear as we talked to some leaders there was that foreign countries and foreign organizations were spending hundreds of millions of dollars to spread misinformation on TikTok, which is and other social media platforms to try to spur up a lot of these protests that were happening on campus. Now, I haven't empirically proven that or I don't know the data on it, but that's sort of what I was told. But it goes beyond that, which is to say that even the media, everyone has their own version. The media is decentralized. There's a lot of fake information out there, false information out there, and it is the source of a lot of what is going on in these schools today. It's what's causing people to dislike each other and to have views that maybe aren't even based in fact. What do we do about that? Is it something we should be doing? Is there something we should be doing, or is it just a symptom of society and we have to accept it?
So I had one pitch that I've been pitching to various people at universities, and so far nobody's caught it, so maybe they know better. But I think that the one thing the universities can and should do is they should identify those topics that are seen as so incendiary that students are unwilling to talk about them in a balanced way, and they should say, that's our job. We will have the president introduce these speakers who are going to debate, or it doesn't have to be a debate. It could be a panel. It could be a discussion. Israel and Palestine, transgender athletes in women's sports, youth gender medicine, abortion is another example, affirmative action. And first, because the students don't seem to be getting it from their classmates or sometimes, regrettably, from professors. And second, precisely to model for them civil discourse about difficult topics and to highlight to them, yes, we do want to legitimize, not necessarily particular position in that, but we want to legitimize because you have to understand it as legitimate, the idea of talking about these things that obviously are contentious topics of debate, obviously get some people very upset, but that cannot be a reason not to have a discussion.
I support that. So if we're talking about foreign-funded misinformation, there are two pieces of it. So in terms of misinformation, I have to say misinformation is bad, but efforts to combat it can be worse. Oftentimes we try to combat misinformation by discouraging access to sources of information that we disagree with and I think it's a mess, and I think that the tech companies are not particularly good at. When it comes to foreign-funded turmoil on the college campuses, I think there are different dimensions of it, but I have to give the caveat that there are more people talking about it than there are presenting evidence about it. And right now there's enough evidence that some intelligence officials are talking about it, and I have to expect that they have some evidence, but I haven't seen enough to go to court with. But there are two aspects of this. One is foreign funding, especially illegally undisclosed foreign funding, of U.S. campuses, U.S. Post-secondary institutions, sometimes in violation of disclosure requirements. So that can potentially influence the university's decision-making, which is always a bad thing. The second is foreign contributions to extremist student organizations, which has a different set of challenges. But as I tried to indicate before, while those can be very bad, especially if there are enemies of the United States who are deliberately trying to undermine our institutions, we have to realize that in some ways the biggest problems are homegrown with misinformation that's generated sometimes through the public schools, sometimes through public school related unions, and a myriad of other sources.
I couldn't agree more that the dangerous as misinformation of all kinds is analogous to hate speech. It's far more dangerous to empower the government or any authorities to decide what fits within that inevitably subjective and overly broad and manipulable concept. Let me just give you one example from exactly 1 week ago. I was at Yale University debating the author of a trendy new anti-free speech book, Marianne Franks, a professor at George Washington University Law School. And she opened her argument for more censorship and against free speech by declaring, it wasn't hypothesizing, it was a declaration that the biggest, most dramatic proof we had of the danger of speech is the fact that Donald Trump was elected, because that meant that people were buying into disinformation.
Let me just add something.
And that is not an endorsement of Donald Trump.
So let me just broaden it to the general influence, outside influences on what the learning environment can be in a very practical way. So several years ago, back before smartphones, which was not that long ago, we at the law school turned off the Wi-Fi in all the classrooms because the faculty felt that the students were on their laptops and they were on the internet and they were distracted and weren't concentrating. I'll say, at the time, as a faculty member, I was a skeptic that we should do that. But I really noticed, like, the degree of concentration and engagement with the students was tremendous. Of course, the technology has changed. Like, now, like, it's impossible to do that. But the other sort of piece that's connected to this that goes back to Nadine's point about peer pressure, I mean, we also hear from our students about interactions they are having with one another on social media that then is affecting their relationships with each other and affecting their willingness to engage with one another in the classroom. And it's something that as an institution, as a school, how do we police that? Like, how do we, like, influence how the students are communicating with each other in this medium which is completely outside of our control to even monitor? It continues to be a very real challenge, but the effects are tangible.
All right, let's go over here to Ilya.
Right. Ilya Shapiro, Manhattan Institute, and a veteran of the campus speech wars, and perhaps even more importantly, a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, where last year Dean Miles gave just a tremendous presentation about Chicago's approach to all this stuff. I was so impressed by that, I put it in my book that's coming out, so you'll be in that, Tom, whether you like that or not.
Thank you.
Lawless. But my question is not about what we should do about all this stuff. It's not rocket science. If you want something hard, there's a panel on AI next door, which I'm sure is completely incomprehensible, at least to me. But Tom said this initially, he's the exception that proves the rule. And so what I would like to ask from all of your different perspectives, why are so few, especially law school deans, because I think it's, you know, respectively more dangerous in law schools than English departments or sociology departments or what have you, after all, lawyers are the gatekeepers of our institutions, why are so few law school leaders, deans and others, willing to do the right thing? Is it law and econ, you know, Chicago incentives? Is it they're all bad people, they're immoral? Is it they're amoral and they're just weak? If the answers are relatively clear about what kind of policies to have and how to enforce them, why are so few doing it?
Ilya, may I quote you? It's one of the most quotable things that you've ever said, so it ranks very high. When we were both speaking at an academic freedom conference at Stanford, and I will never forget it, you said the problem with all of these deans, well, you went beyond deans, so-called leaders, is not that they are woke activists, but that they are spineless wimps.
I think I said cowards, but yes.
So I'll put it perhaps more politely. So I think I've been dean just, you know, a few weeks or months when there was this collective letter. Now I don't even remember what the issue was. There was some collective letter that was being signed by all the deans. And citing our Calvin principles, I refused to sign it. And I was maybe one of five deans out of 200 law schools not to sign it. It's a lonely place. And then a week later, the Wall Street Journal called to say, we want to know why your dean didn't sign. So the peer pressure is not just at the student level.
All right, let's go over here.
Kai Alberg, Washington State. I have two sons in college currently, so my question is partly based on their experiences. Going beyond the need to enforce the law and to equally enforce policies, I want to put two statements to the panel and get your reaction. One is, a lot of the problem, at least in many universities, lies with a lack of ideological intellectual diversity at the faculty and administrator level rather than with the students, leading to bias and to lack of diversity of expression in the classroom and on campus. Second, a large part of the problem is that our students at the high school level, by and large, no longer learn critical thinking. They are not exposed to opposing views and do not learn how to civilly debate people they strongly disagree with. In my state of Washington, we have something called the youth legislature, where students draft legislation, they debate it, they vote on it. It's a great program teaching these skills. In my son's high school, 3% of the students participate voluntarily. The other 97% don't. They don't get these skills.
Anyone want to respond?
Well, the viewpoint diversity issue is a profound one. It was what gave rise to one of a number of new organizations that are responding to all of these problems, Heterodox Academy. And there, in fact, I listened to a Heterodox Academy webinar just yesterday or the day before about a new Indiana law that you may have heard about, which mandates viewpoint diversity in each class, and Heterodox Academy and other groups that support viewpoint diversity are troubled because the law is written in a way that's kind of vague and overly broad and may have adverse unintended consequences. And other people have suggested affirmative action for faculty members based on viewpoint, and that also has some downsides. So, Kai, what I'm telling you from the act, from the organizations, and they include intellectual scholars as well as policy people, they're having a hard time coming up with solutions to this problem.
So we have time for one quick question, because we're almost out of time. Let's go over here.
Daniel Kelly from Wisconsin. Good afternoon. I wholly subscribe to everything you've said about the importance of free speech in general, and specifically with respect to the university campus. But my question is, who's responsible for transmitting Western civilization to the next generation? You know, campus chaos has manifested many times as a challenge to the notion of free speech at all, right? Can the university afford to be agnostic about whether free speech is valuable as opposed to the alternative? Can the university afford to be agnostic about whether we have mutual respect or instead anti-Semitism or the rule of law or its alternative? And after all, the university is not just a high-priced debating society, it's pedagogical. The point of the liberal arts is to form the students so that they can be a vessel for passing down Western civilization to the next generation. So is the university responsible for that? And how does that interact with what you've said this afternoon about free speech?
We have time for a quick answer, too.
Yes, universities are too few are doing well. There are some promising developments. For years, I think at Princeton, Robbie George's center was a model, and there have been others like that. I think that more recently, the Hamilton Center at the University of Florida is something exciting to look at, and there are also centers, whether they refer to Western civilization or civic thought or the like, from Arizona to Ohio State and elsewhere. But because faculty is such a big challenge here, if you have faculty who are not committed to it, then you need to have a faculty solution. And sometimes the faculty solution might include developing new centers, bringing on new people, developing curricula. That's
all right. So that's the end of the program. I am obligated, though, to read something. So one brief announcement on CLE. If you are pursuing CLE, since it's the last panel of the day, please be sure to check out by scanning the QR code you scanned when you checked in. So please give, with that announcement done, please give a huge round of applause to our panelists.